Session number 13265, reel number 26.
I think perhaps in the Air Force, because of the nature of the service and the nature of the people who go into it with an interest in aircraft and so on, you get a little bit more curiosity. So as I say, we walked along the strip and had a look at the various squadrons along the way. There was a naval squadron with Hellcats. There were several odd aircraft parked which had lobbed in perhaps from operations and gone US. And we walked right down to the far end where there were one or two squadrons, I'm not sure, of TBFs, Grumman Avengers. And as it happened, we got there just as one of these Avengers had been parked and they were lowering a bomb out of the bomb bay. The thing had been on an operation and apparently had gone to bomb a ship or something else, something of that order, and the bomb had hung up and now required dealing with. I gather that the bomb was fused and so I had to be lowered off a little bit carefully onto the bomb trolley and then brought away from the aircraft, and the fuse had to be dealt with. Well, they didn't bring the bomb trolley very far from the aircraft, about 20 foot, and the chap who was going to deal with the bomb, when I suggested that they perhaps ought to shift it further away in case anything went crook, was a bit shirty and used some very Anglo-Saxon terms at us, telling us he knew what he was doing and so on. So we stood and watched until he sat down on the bomb itself and had a look at the kind of ring nut, which I suppose covered the fuse, and put a bar into it and tried to turn it and couldn't turn the nut. So then he opened his toolbox, one of those flap-topped toolboxes where you open it up and you get trays come out, and he took out a hammer, a ball-peen hammer, an engineer's hammer, and then he had a look, I supposed, for a drift, a kind of punch, couldn't find one, and came up with a biggish cold chisel, which he applied to the ring nut and was going to strike it, and I said, "Hold it." And he looked up. I said, "Before you do that," I said, "are you sure that's what you want to do?" And I got some more language. I said, "Right, well, before you do it, give me and these bods time to get back." The New Zealanders, the Kiwis, who, as I said, innocents in this sort of thing, would have been quite prepared to stand and watch him. But I suggested it might be better for us all if we moved out of the way. So we moved back a bit, and I found a pile of coral that's been left over from grading the strip out and making the blast bays, and I suggested we get behind that and get down, which we did. And this character, Petty Officer Armourer, a Petty Officer First, three red stripes on his sleeve, proceeded to lay into the ring nut on this bomb with his hammer and cold chisel, with of course what I regard as an inevitable result. There's a sudden kapow and the whole thing goes up with him sitting on it, and there's muck and corruption flying in all directions, and of course the blast blew the kite over and exploded, set the kite on fire, and that exploded. And then of course there's 50 caliber rounds and 30 caliber rounds, petrol tanks and oil tanks, oxygen bottles, Lord knows what, creating a hell of a mess. And I made sure my blokes kept their heads down and we didn't poke our heads up to watch all this interesting stuff at all, until it got quiet. And then we noticed there was a strong smell of roast pork. Of course, we were in the right place. In the islands, cooked human being is known as long pig. And human flesh, when burned or roasted at the appropriate temperature, smells just like roast pork, if anyone wants to know. Anyway, we didn't stay to find out anything about courts of inquiry or anything. Somebody dashed up, wanted to know what was happened, so I told him, and we left. I didn't want to be involved with being a witness to all this daftness. Another little incident was unloading an LCT. We needed unleaded petrol for our truck engines, and I wasn't about to allow the use of the aviation spirit of the leaded petrol, which was being used in a good deal of the motor transport on the island as well, because it was easier just to use the one kind of fuel, because I knew darn well that if we began to start sticking 100 octane petrol through our Crosley engines, we'd burn our valves, because they were not designed for that kind of fuel. They were designed for the old style straight spirit. We needn't go into petrol engine technology here, need we? Or need we?
I don't think so.
Righto. So I'd insisted on getting 70 octane spirit, which was what was being used in the cookhouse burners. And that meant, of course, that the supplies had to be increased, since we were adding to the general consumption. So when a delivery of this 70 octane stuff came up, we were invited to take part in unloading it, to get the stuff on, get the landing craft unloaded before the Japs got onto it and perhaps organise a strike. So we went down to Golden Beach and we took part in unloading this thing, all of us working at a rate of knots, rolling these 44-gallon barrels off the landing craft and onto the beach and hoiking them up into the trucks to be carted away. Well, we all worked. It was pretty well midday and furiously hot and drawn. We worked so furiously that most of us stripped off, and as a result, I got a severe dose of sunburn on the back. Although we were running in sweat, I'd always taken good care not to do too much sunbathing and whatnot, risking sunburn, having seen what happened to a chap on the troop ship going out. Did I mention that?
Don't think so.
There were several chaps on the troop ship in the RAF contingent who were determined to get a beautiful brown tan. One of them stripped off down to his shorts, to underpants, and went to sleep in the shade on the deck, on where we were, on our deck, on the trooper. What he didn't allow for was the fact that he went to sleep in the shade at the end of a zig, and when the ship zagged, he was in the sun. And when he woke up, he made one movement, yelled, and fainted. He'd been absolutely burned top to bottom, and he was in the sick bay for some time, which was enough encouragement for me to avoid it as much as possible. Anyway, I got a badly sunburned back, which I bore up with, and what I didn't know was that eventually I gather in the open sunburn, flies got into it and laid their eggs. So that when I got a really sore back, I went down to the sick bay and I found out that I was attending sick bay twice a day to have my back swabbed with benzoic acid and salicylic acid. I suppose the salicylic acid was intended to be a painkiller for the benzoic acid, but as far as I was concerned, it was like having my back swabbed with rocket fuel, and it made me sweat a bit. That lasted, well, that took rather more than a week. And the tropical islands are not the handiest places to get injuries of that order, because round about the same time I'd had to undo a couple of crates of I forget what the term is. What do you call those big glass bottles about so big?
Oh yes, I know. Jeroboams.
No, it's a technical term rather than a brewery or a wine term. God, anyway.
Yes, I know what you mean. No.
Yeah. Anyway, I'd had to. We got some of those delivered with distilled water in. This was before we made our own still, and I'd scraped myself on the slats of the packing case in doing it. I got a scrape on the chest and one on my shin. Within a week, I got tropical sores there, and I was attending the sick bay to have these scraped twice a day by the sick bay attendant, who took a lancet or some such thing and carefully scraped the wound each day and dusted it with sulfanilamide powder. Before the one on the shin cleaned up, he was scraping it just about down to the bone. You could just about see the bone in the bottom. Wasn't too keen on that, really. Another little incident. One day I was off duty, lying on the cot in the tent, and I hear a bang overhead. Shoot outside to see what's going on. Cut my foot on the coral, because I'm barefoot. And that doesn't please me, because coral cuts can be nasty. Luckily it's dead coral, so it's not so bad. Look overhead, and there's a shower of gubbins in the air. And I look up and I think, good heavens, a Mitchell has exploded. And then I think, no, a Mitchell would be green and these are blue. It's two aeroplanes. And then I work out that it's two F4U Vought Corsairs which have collided. And what I can see is the bits flying apart. And it takes a surprisingly long time. You know, I'm thinking all this through, and it's this stuff's all still happening in the air. It takes a remarkably long time for stuff like this to come down. There's an engine flying out to sea. There's a propeller spinning like an ash key, twirling out to the sea. There are wings floating down. I mean, these wings weigh half a ton or so, or something of that order, with their guns in or one thing or other, and they're twizzling down as though they're tissue paper. And we see a speck coming down, and we run towards the edge of the cliff where the quarry is and look down, because below us in that semicircular area there are some of the tents, the ready tents of the Corsair squadron. And we see this speck come down, and as it gets low enough we realise that it's a head, completely flying helmet, one thing or another, just the head. And believe it or not, it went splat clean into the entrance, into the doorway of the tent from which the air crew of that Corsair squadron, and probably this Bud's mates, are just rushing out to see what's going on. And I see this head go splat in the doorway just as a body's stepping out, and it lands between his feet. And he looks down and realises what it is and vomits into it. And gets pushed out of the way by the others who are running out to see what's going on. By which time, the tangled wreckage from the bits of the two aircraft is dropping down onto the strip, not very far away. And meanwhile, we also see a body coming down. It's the other pilot who's bailed out, and he's frantically pulling his D-ring to operate the ripcord to operate his chute. We see the pilot chute stream out, and we see the parachute stream out, and he's getting very close to the deck, and suddenly the parachute inflates with a plop, and you get a cloud of French chalk or whatever off the silk or nylon, and it opens, and he's about 15 foot off the deck, which means that he's still travelling pretty sharply when he hits the deck, and he hit the deck with his shoulder, and I heard afterwards that he smashed his shoulder, but he was dead lucky, because I suppose these jokers were about 300 odd feet when they collided. It was a nasty affair altogether. Anyway, the wreckage came down, of course, and that starts to burn, and there's 50 calibre ammunition flying in all directions, so we retreat pretty rapidly from the edge of the cliff, of the edge of the quarry, and let the stuff fly where it will. We can hear it flipping through the branches of the trees around us, shredding the trees, and odd bangs and puffs, and of course the usual big column of black smoke that you get from an aircraft wreck as the petrol and oil burns. Another little incident derived from the New Zealanders' shortage of materiel. Wherever they could, they salvaged the small Japanese barges, a kind of sampan type thing with a wheelhouse right aft and a long foredeck. They salvaged them and got them into commission again, got the engines working and so on, and used them up and down the coast of the island for shifting stuff, or for just going out fishing on the reef or whatever. And on the foredeck they painted a big black circle, a disc I should say, since it was not a ring, 6 or 8 feet across, and on that they painted a white kiwi, thinking that that would be a good enough sign, since everybody should know that New Zealanders have the kiwi as their emblem. But from time to time they were shot up by the hot shots from the VMF squadrons, the Boeington's mob, the Black Sheep and the Flying Deuces, and they rather resented it. They took up a view altogether. And I gather that it got to the point where I got this from the New Zealanders themselves, it got to the point where they said, look, if you come and strafe us again when we're at sea in one of these things and there's this dirty great kiwi on the front, we're going to fire back. And the Yanks laughed. You know. Anyway, I don't know how it came about, but I'm down at Golden Beach one day, and in comes this barge, and draped across the kiwi at the front is a figure lying very still in flight overalls, which are by no means perfect or intact, because they've been fairly slashed about a bit, and there's black stains all over the place. One of the Corsair mob had attacked the barge, and the Kiwis had let him have it back and shot him down, and picked the dead pilot up and brought him back, and simply they just came bows into the beach and sent one of the Yanks as a runner and said, fetch your squadron commander here, we've got one, we think this is yours. And I gather that that sort of quietened them down, and after that there were no more attacks on the salvaged barges. The other side event of our staying in the islands was to be invited up to the New Zealand 3rd Div headquarters for Christmas dinner, Christmas Eve, Christmas dinner, and Christmas Day jollifications. I suppose they were, I don't know, 5 or 10 miles further up the island than we were. They were a little way past the island cinema, which was a coconut theatre, if you like. There was a place in a coconut plantation, which was a cup-shaped arena, if you like, and in this, if you imagine cupping your hand and tilting it at an angle, then we've got the shape of the thing. And if you take your right hand on the bottom edge, little finger edge of the hand, if you put up a large canvas screen and imagine semicircular rows of seats in the cup of the hand, then you've got the picture of this theatre. And the seats were provided by cutting down the coconut palms at the appropriate height, cutting them off square, and nailing boards across the tops, so that we have a typical Roman arena style thing. And here the island cinema shows were put on, and here the New Zealanders had built a stage and were going to put on their Christmas show. So we go up there. By the way, at Christmas we got a ration of 6 bottles of beer, 6 New Zealand quarts, which is a curious size bottle. It's not an actual quart. I don't know what exactly the measure is, but it's a heck of a sight bigger than a pint bottle. And Waikato beer from the Waikato brewery. Quite good. We understood that there'd probably been 12 bottles each man, started out from New Zealand, but as always happens with things like this, the amount had dwindled on its way up with each handling, which is a not unusual thing in the service, in the armed forces. Anyway, we all got 6 quart bottles of beer and a large ration of cigarettes. Unfortunately, the cigarettes, as far as smokers were concerned, were Victory V's, which by all accounts were made up from the sweepings of the Cairo bazaars, mostly camel dung. I was a non-smoker, and I think most of my chaps were, but I smelled one of these things when somebody was smoking it, and it was foul. What we did was to give ours to a few of the local natives, the Kanakas. And incidentally, speaking of those people, it was there I discovered that one of the, what the Americans thought was the name of the village where they lived, and it's a name which you tend to see through the islands as a place name, simply meant the place where we live. It wasn't an actual place name in our sense at all. When they asked the Kanakas what they called it, they said so-and-so, meaning this is where we live.
Meaning village, often.
Meaning, yes, the place where we live. A name like Morotai or some such name or other. I've long forgotten that. Anyway, the beer was welcome. The going price for beer in the islands, New Zealand beer in the quart bottle, the going price was $15 a bottle. So if we didn't want to drink it, it was a useful trade item. You could trade one bottle of beer for a Remington rifle or a Japanese rifle. And for 2 bottles of beer, you could get a Winchester carbine, which was a very desirable little tool. So certainly the New Zealanders thought so, because they all had ambitions to have one. First of all, because it's small, you can lose it in a kit bag. And secondly, it's a standard calibre, 30. 30 calibre, and thirdly, it's ideal for pig shooting in New Zealand. So all my New Zealand lads latched onto one of those right sharply. We found one or two Marines who were arms dealers in a small way. I carried a Japanese rifle back with me to New Zealand, dismantled in a kit bag, which I sold to one of my crowd who wanted it. Those were .26 calibre, I think.
But presumably the American rifles must have been pinched from the forces.
Pinched? Pinched? You mean borrowed? Presumably, yes. We weren't buying them from the New Zealanders. Oh no, we were buying them from the Americans. We didn't steal them. We bought them. $15 is a fair price, isn't it? Anyway, so we spent Christmas there. We had the Christmas concert was a marvellous affair. They had a full chorus line, blondes, all looking very shapely, in a rugby club sort of fashion. I can't remember whether there was a full orchestra or just a piano, but there was music, and so, you know, the thing that struck me at the time, and I've thought of it since, was to draw a parallel with that poem of Siegfried Sassoon's, Egyptian Concert Party. They are gathering round. Out of the gathering darkness they come. How does it go? The rattle and thump of a piano, tum-ti-tum, and so on. When Siegfried Sassoon, I think, was in Egypt, was he? 1917 or so. It struck me that this was one of the things that I would remember from the war most distinctly. There was a femme fatale, and you wouldn't have known she was a fella at all. It was the whole show. It was a really excellent show. If it had been taken back to New Zealand and put on stage in a theatre there, they'd have filled the house. The comedy was good. The songs were good. The singers were good. The talent is, you know, you get a big enough group of army types or service types together, and you find you've got talent. And it was really was marvellous. And then it finished off, of course, with God Save the King. And we all walked away very quietly. Quite odd. Everyone talking very quietly. Anyway, the following day, Christmas dinner. What do we have? Brussels sprouts, turkey, new potatoes or equivalent thereof, coomeras, of course, which I can't stand, and Christmas pud. Temperature's about 110, humidity's about 110, and we woof this lot back like billy-o. Every man has a bottle of beer extra on the table alongside his place. That's, frankly, it was, as far as I was concerned, it was the best Christmas of the war I had up there in the islands. I can remember at Linton-on-Ouse,